We think we're pretty clever with our feats of engineering and our inventiveness, but we stand on the shoulders of the pioneers of innovation and those who laid out the principles on which our ingenuity depends. The wonders of the world are many. The pyramids, the pagodas, the palaces, the Great Wall of China, the monasteries that seem to cling mystically to the cliff edge. And our breath is taken away by the mystery and the majesty of what they've done, those ancient engineers and architects. How did they do that? Bridges where no bridge should be. Temples of extraordinary loveliness and intricacy, and cathedrals centuries in the making. And of such beauty, you just have to fall silent in face of their astonishing, awe-inspiring loveliness. Water was always an issue in the ancient world, an engineering challenge. How to harness it, catch it, store it, keep it safe. How to make sure you had some when the enemy was at the gate and your city was under siege. The Justinian cisterns in Istanbul, amazing. This cathedral size cistern is an underground chamber about 9,800 square meters in area, capable of holding 80,000 cubic meters of water. The ceiling is supported by a forest of 336 marble columns, each 9 meters high, 30 feet high, arranged in 12 rows of 28 columns each, 16 feet apart. The cistern has the capacity to store 100,000 tons of water. An amazing place where concerts are held and you can sit in one of the strangest coffee shops in the world. Not part of the original construction, I hasten to add. Or the astonishing hill fortress of Masada, which stands in the middle of the Judean desert, a monument to Herod's impossible dream. The cisterns in the side of Masada can hold 10 million gallons of water, with secret passages so that the inhabitants could draw water without an enemy being aware of it. It was all about water, impossible aqueducts spanning valleys. Water, a real issue in a world where clean running water was more dream than reality. People knew you couldn't drink drachmas and denarii. Have you ever been thirsty? So thirsty your mouth so dry, your lips so parched, your tongue cleaving to the roof of your mouth. Have you ever been so thirsty that you would have given every Swiss franc in your wallet for just one drink of cold, refreshing water, please? Have you ever been so thirsty that you would have died had you not got that drink, that beautiful, sweet drink? Have you ever been really thirsty? The fugitive Hebrews, going around in circles in the baking heat of the wilderness, they understood what it meant to be thirsty. To know that if you didn't get a drink very soon, you would be dead. A simple but significant truth, and that is that without water, you're doomed. The vital necessity for survival, the crucial place of water in the continuance of the human race. You can survive for 3 weeks without food, but only 4 days without water. And we can only shudder when we hear the United Nations Secretary's General Various, who warned of the link between water and the potential for war, including Boutros-Ghali in 1985, who said, "The next war in the Middle East will be fought over water, not politics." Ban Ki-moon, who warned in 2007, "Water scarcity threatens economic and social gains and is a potent fuel for wars and conflict." When the astronauts landed on the moon, they found a dead planet where nothing lived, nothing grew, and they could only bring back moon dust. We can live without TVs and computers and mobile phones, yes we can, but not without water. It's one of those great sombre, reminding themes of Western movies when the prospectors find the gold and they start making their way home only to find there's no water in their bottles, they've run out of water, and the sheer uselessness of all their gold is revealed. Their real need, their basic need, is for that simple thing, H2O. Nothing else matters. If they could, they would swap all their gold for one cool, thirst-quenching drink, a life-saving drink of water. It was not so very different for the children of Israel. In the passage we read, they were free, but thirsty, far from Pharaoh's slave drivers, but desperately close to dying of thirst. We find it hard to get into the mindset of people who live with that crisis every day. Normally we can water our garden, our pets can be given something to drink, we have all the water we need. Most of us will know nothing about the effects of drought, the vulnerability it brings, the disaster it threatens, especially in this city. It's easy to become blasé, cavalier and casual about the importance of water and people's dependence on it. We might feel a bit thirsty on a very hot day or after robust exercise, but that's soon dealt with by the turn of a tap or some fizzy water from the fridge. For others, it's a very different story. 633 million people in the world lack access to clean water. 663 million people. That's one person without safe water out of every 10 people with it. Over 80% of the disease in developing countries is related to poor drinking water and sanitation. 4,500 children die every day from preventable diseases related to lack of access to clean water, adequate sanitation and hygiene. The UN estimates it would cost an additional $30 billion to provide access to safe water to the entire planet. That's a third of what the world spends in a year on bottled water. In face of these reminders, perhaps the very least we can be is thankful that this is not our experience, this is not how it is for us, and be a bit more sensitive to the possible crisis points faced across the globe by so many people. As we've seen, one of the first priorities of the caring agencies is the provision of clean water in areas of particular vulnerability and need. And so the aid agencies provide barrels for transportation, pipes for irrigation, artesian wells to pump water into the villages, reservoirs to preserve what rainwater there is. These are life and death situations that we've seen decade upon decade in parts of Africa. It requires real imaginative and emotional leaping on our part to feel something of that utter fragility as day after day after relentless day the sun beats down on people. We might grumble if it rains on our day off or holiday or at the picnic that we planned. Maybe when we find ourselves sensitive to the situation of others and vitally aware of the truth that without that rain we're all dead, our priorities might shift, our thinking might be changed. So even looked at its simplest level, its lowest common denominator, the story of the people of Israel and their plight in the unforgiving dryness of the wilderness can inspire us to an attitude of gratitude that's expressed in a commitment to fair shares for all. An editorial in the Observer newspaper quoted a UNICEF report that says, "To provide clean water supplies for everyone in the world, thus greatly reducing disease in the third world, would require an annual budget that is 1/11 of what the rich world spends each year on alcohol." As the Lord used the faith of Moses and his obedience to be an instrument for the provision of water for the people, the challenge comes to us with pretty unmistakable clarity that we too work his miracles of love and justice. Through faith and obedience, we see that the agencies that do this work and could do this work have the resources, the raw materials of technology, the expertise and engineering skills are there. Just one more thing is needed, and that's the will to see it through. There's a website on the order of service if you want to do something about it. That said, there's always a dangerous tendency to spiritualise these kinds of stories and see them simply as a metaphor for some deep metaphysical issue. And we're going to do that a bit in a moment. But as we move on to see what the story meant for the people on a spiritual level, we must be sure not to diminish what it's saying to us on a very practical level, what it says to our pocket, as well as what it says to our hearts. To a people whose lives were shaped by the geography and geology of the desert, prey to the whims of the wilderness, its winds, sandstorms, the screaming void of its vast emptiness, to people who lived on a knife edge between famine and survival, it's no wonder that water, this crucial key to survival, this basic essential without which there would be nothing, should take on a spiritual, mystical, symbolic overtone, become a sacred commodity. And so the poetry and the prophecy of the Old Testament is packed tight with examples of the comparison between the cracked, parched earth, the stunted growth, the dried up crops of a waterless, forbidding moonscape, and the soul that is without God, without the refreshing experience of the presence of God, like water on a thirsty land. The psalmist David, feeling the absence of God, aware of the broken connection between himself and his Lord, says, "My soul pants for thee as a young deer does for a spring of water." For he knows that the man who obeys the law of God is, as he says, like a tree planted by a river, growing strong and straight and fruitful. The prophet Isaiah says, "Come, you that are thirsty, and drink in the living presence of God." The Old Testament writers, with their deep insights, consider the idea of anyone thinking they might enjoy life to the full without God to be as naive and ludicrous as thinking you can live long and well without water. Try to stumble along without the continuing influence of a walk with God, and you'll find little sense of inner peace, no bubbling spring of inner joy to sustain and enrich. The powerful symbol of water and its sustaining, refreshing, life-giving power is carried over into the New Testament. Jesus meets a woman at a well and promises her living water, the soul-cleansing, personality-invigorating experience of the presence of Christ and his love within her heart, within her life. Disbelieving, the woman asks, "What, will I never thirst again? Never again know the hollow ache of lonesomeness and shame that go to the very core of her being? The emptiness of a life without purpose?" "That's right," says Jesus. "Trust in me. Allow me to be Lord of your life, and you will find welling up within your soul the pulsing, cascading stream of spiritual life." Not that you'll never experience the harsher realities of real human experience, but that within you, you will find soul strength and deep comfort and real hope, because the life of Christ is in you. A life without prayer, meditation on the sweeping truths of the faith, a life without worship as the individual spirit drinks in the soaring chords and the profound poetry of the hymns, a life without the warm fellowship of other Christians, a life without the beauty and the healing of the sacraments and the proclamation of sins forgiven, will soon find the desert encroaches, dust and heat, where nothing survives and nothing grows. Walk through any major city on a Saturday night or early on a Sunday morning and see the quality of life many people choose for themselves. Relationships that are shoddy, short-term and self-interested. Lifestyles that are dangerous and damaging. A choice to live for the moment that fails to take any account of the long-term implications. A generation driven by pleasure-seeking and instant gratifications that seldom seems to raise its eyes, its vision, above the immediate, and to heck with the risks. The concerns expressed about modern culture and the high price it demands from those who immerse themselves in it are not the sole preserve of those with a religious perspective. Health officials, social workers, politicians, educationalists huddle together to shake their heads at the folly upon folly of those who embrace the short-termism, the headstrong, headlong, all-night-long dash towards the hedonistic lifestyle that cares not a jot for tomorrow or my neighbour. And the wider world, the disadvantaged world, grows more alarmed as new generations emerge in the West who show little interest in wider social obligations and responsibilities. Some do. Of course some do. But many seem dedicated to worship of the twin gods, me and now. Contrast that with David and his tree planted by the riverside, its roots going deep, deep, drawing strength and sustenance from the crystal clear river. He shall not be moved. Blessed is the man or woman who takes the living water of Christ into their life. For most people, the closest they get to a desert is watching a Western on TV, a scatter of bleached white bones, the last remains of the team of oxen that never made it across the unforgiving terrain and were abandoned by the wagon train. The sweltering, oppressive heat that dehydrates and destroys as effectively as any rifle bullet, cracked lips, blinded eyes, the glare, water, water, and the vulture circle, patient and certain. And then the sheer explosive joy of the discovery of a watering hole. Just when hope was dying, and the disbelieving hero runs, his tired legs given new strength, and laughing and whooping in relief and joy, he throws himself into the pool of water, and he uses his hat to pour it over this delicious life-giving stuff, this wet gold, all over himself. And he laughs, and he laughs, because his terrible thirst is ended, and he will live. He has found water for his parched body. "Sir," the woman said, "give me that water, then I will never be thirsty again."